Welcome to Crossroads, a podcast that explores the intersection of faith and Christian living. Crossroads is part of the media ministry at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Get to know us by visiting us online at fapc.org.
Hi, I'm Jamie Staley, Director of Christian Education at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. Welcome to a special episode of Crossroads Podcast. In this conversation, we revisit the 1973 film Godspell with Don Scardino, the original Broadway Jesus, who performed the role over 1,000 times. Don joined us to answer questions, share stories, and reflect on how Godspell has shaped his faith and the faith of many others. This conversation was recorded as part of a live adult education event. If you haven't seen the film yet, I encourage you to pause here, watch it on your favorite streaming service, and then return for this insightful conversation. For those of you I don't know, I'm Jamie Staley. I'm the Director of Christian Education here at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. And I am so excited to be kicking off our fall adult education programming with this viewing of Godspell. When Scott originally told us as a senior staff that the sermon series was going to be Jesus the Jester, I immediately thought of Godspell. And those of you who have seen it before may know why. Those of you who have not seen it before, you're going to find out very quickly why I was excited. And so I emailed Scott and I said, Scott, I'm thinking that this might be something fun to do for the whole congregation if we watched Godspell together. I think it would fit in really nicely with Jesus the Jester and really just be a great event. And he replied, do you know that Don Scardino is a member here at Fifth Avenue? And he originated the role of Jesus in Godspell on Broadway. And he played over 1,000, he's played Jesus over 1,000 shows. And just to let you know. And I immediately went to Austin's office and I said, Austin, can I email Don Scardino? To which Austin said, sure, go ahead, try. I don't know, see what he says. So I did, and Don sent a most amazing email back telling me all about his role as Jesus in Godspell, all of the amazing things he learned while he played Jesus, all of the amazing people that he was able to meet, and just how Godspell really has shaped his faith throughout the years. And so I am thrilled to be welcoming Don Scardino this afternoon to watch the movie with us and also to do some question and answer time. So please join me in welcoming him.
Hello, everyone. Hi. Is this on? Is this good?
It's on.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. How many people have seen Godspell on stage first? On stage. That's good. How many people have seen this movie? How many people still love it and want to see it again? Okay. All right. Well, it's my honor to be here. I've been a member of the church since the Brian Kirkland days, and I love Scott. I'm delighted to be here today at Jamie's invitation. So, you have a question?
I do. I actually have, my first question was for the audience.
Okay.
How many of you have never seen Godspell?
That's a good question.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
All right.
What a treat.
Should I give them some background?
That would be great.
For those of you who have never seen Godspell, here's some background. John Michael Tebelak was a Carnegie Mellon student in drama. He was doing his master's thesis, and he went on an Easter Sunday to church. His parents were Russian Orthodox Christians, and it was Easter Sunday, it was snowing, and John Michael Tebelak is a very big dude with a big afro and looked like a real hippie. This is 1969-70, and he went into the church, and they asked him to leave, and he was strip-searched for drugs by a policeman outside because he looked so weird. He was furious, he was incensed, and he had been looking for a thesis project. He had been reading a theologian by the name of Harvey Cox, who had written a book called Feast of Fools, and one chapter was called Christ the Harlequin. And he said, wouldn't it be great if we had an image like Christ the Clown? It would be accessible. It would be something that instead of a gray thing hanging on the wall, this is actually a vibrant, living, funny individual. There must have been something very charismatic about our Lord. So he found it, And he brought the students together and they started working with the Gospels. They didn't have script. They just worked with the Bible and they started illustrating parables and then they added music to it. It became his master's thesis. It was seen. It was brought to New York to the La Mama Theater down on 4th Street. It was then moved to the Cherry Lane Theater where it immediately got rave reviews and sold out. I joined it a little while later, having been friends with all the Carnegie people, and played over 1,000 performances. And 1,000 crucifixions is no picnic, by the way. If you. But it was the idea that you would see, I just did Groucho, you see that? I mean, it was the idea that we could present this character in this way and still tell the passion play. And it reached audiences across the world. At one point, there were 16 companies, 8 in the United States, and the rest were spread across the world. It was the first interracial company in South Africa and became the phenomenon that's still known today. It has fallen into a kind of, oh, it's like Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. It's a kids' movie thing, and it can be a kids' movie. We have kids here. But it's also was a revolutionary piece of theater and a revolutionary piece of looking at the gospel and at the teachings of Jesus. So there you have a little background.
Amazing. Awesome.
Yeah.
So in your initial email to me, you told me a little bit about over the years, some of your experiences, and one of those was being kissed by a nun during intermission in one of the shows, and another was being slapped by an audience member. Why do you think there was such a strong reaction to this show?
Well, you know, a lot of people want to take their Jesus straight. You know, they want it like church, and they were offended. You know, they thought, how can you come? I mean, I wore baggy pants and red shoes with pom-poms on the end, and I had a little red nose, and I had a heart painted on my forehead, and teardrop eyes like Marcel Marceau, and did Groucho Marx impressions, and a lot of people didn't like that. They didn't want their religion that way. Obviously, a lot of people did. I got letters from people. One fellow wrote me a long letter saying he had gone back to his Bible, he had gotten off of heroin, because he'd come to see Godspell. I had the Berrigan brothers. Those of you old enough will remember the Berrigan brothers. They came, sat in the front row, and I thought, what am I doing playing Jesus in front of the Berrigan brothers? It's their business, for God's sake. And they were so moved, and they came to celebrate with Godspell. We used to serve wine at intermission as a symbolic communion. So when the intermission came, we would sing, "You Are the Light of the World," and we'd invite everybody up to share wine with the cast. And they would come up, and one performance, a group of nuns were in the audience, as we often had groups of nuns, and one grabbed me by both my shoulders and gave me a huge kiss on the lips and said, "I've been married to you for 13 years and I never knew you were so cute." I got her number. No, I didn't get her number. And once I was in the Toronto company of Godspell first with some legendary people like Gilda Radner and Martin Short and Eugene Levy and all these Paul Schaefer and all these wonderful people. And at that company, the stage manager came back one day after matinee and said, "There's an audience member would like to speak to Jesus. Would you speak to her?" And I said, "Of course, of course." And I came out and here was this little woman with a Bible in hand. And she said, "Do you believe everything that Jesus said was true?" And I said, "Well, of course I do." And she said, "Then how can you do this show?" And I said, "I don't understand the question." And she said, "Because it's blasphemy." And she knocked me across the face with her Bible. And I was like, "What?" And out from the dressing room comes Marty Short and Eugene Levy. Of course, they weren't famous people then. Otherwise, she might have dropped her Bible. But instead, they kind of just separated her from me and took her away. So there was quite a lot of animosity among some audience members who just couldn't. I remember a Broadway performance when a group of people stood up, from a church of some kind, stood up in the house and left in the middle of the first act. We just stopped and looked at them, and they left. You know, so there was that. It was revolutionary. Mm. You know, I mean, now we're sort of accustomed to it. If you know, I've seen Godspell on this movie or on, you know, high schools do it, camps do it, everybody does it now, colleges do it. And you get very used to its kind of, its affable nature. Forgetting that in 1971, when it first opened, it was radical. It was so transformative, different, and upsetting for some, and enlightening for others, that this idea of Jesus would be presented in this way. And yet it was foolproof. You know, we got standing ovations every night in 1971, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, and that was before standing ovations were de rigueur. You know, the people leapt to their feet because they recognized the teachings. They recognized themselves. Godspell is based on the idea, like church should be, which is that it's interactive, and that God comes to meet you. So this show just put his heart on his sleeve and said, hi, day by day, got everybody clapping, sing along 20 minutes into the show. So once you do that, the audience is like here in the palm of your hand. And then you watch each little person come to Jesus, and then they turn to the audience and say, you are the light of the world. You, come on up and have wine with us. And then you do that, and that's the intermission. And then the second act, hold it. We have another story to tell you. And then they tell the story of the Passion Play, which, of course, for us has become such a familiar story that its impact has been kind of lost. But when you see it after having seen the first act with these clowns telling the story in this warm, jubilant, loving version of the parables, and now you see the Passion Play, its impact is overwhelming because you say, well, wait a minute, don't do that. He's funny. If nothing else, he's funny. But, I mean, look at all this love on the stage. Why would you do this to this fellow? And that's what happens in the play. And so the idea of the Passion Play is so powerfully rendered that, you know, it's why the show has endured to this day. It's why we can sit here today and watch that and be inspired again, you know, and enlightened again by it. And now a song.
I got excited. I have one more question that we'll do now, and then we'll do some more Q&A afterwards. Sure. And this one's a little bit more serious. You mentioned the script largely is taken from the Book of Matthew, and you said in your email that doing this night after night really inscribed Matthew on your soul. How did doing this show shape your faith?
Well, you know, I was raised in a Methodist household. My parents were both people of faith, and I had a wonderful minister that I just thought was great. And at that time, when I was a young lad, I wanted to be either an actor or a minister, and I wasn't sure which. Not knowing that they both borrow from each other. And then getting the role and playing Jesus every night for over 1,000 performances and saying Matthew. I mean, I still remember when I did Shakespeare, I still remember bits and pieces of the Shakespeare because the writing is so amazing. It's still in here. But saying Matthew every night, it just got deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper because this is the great wisdom of the world. So to not only say it every night and try and portray it every night and make it ring for people and make it have meaning for people, that element of the audience was the thing that inscribed it on my soul. It was because the recognition from the audience and the love and the appreciation for what the play represented was so profound for so many people. So, and I can still, do not suppose I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to complete. What? Where'd that come from? You know, every once in a while the play, you know. You know, I watch the political scene and I say, you know, I won't get into it, but Matthew is very concerned with prophecy. You know, you will hear the noise of battle near at hand. Nation will make war upon nation, kingdom upon kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in many places, but with all these things, the birth pangs of a new age begin. That's profound. And it's something to remember today, you know, with what's going on. It's the birth pangs of a new age. So, that's why it was inscribed on my soul, why it's never left me, and why, you know, I was sick for the last week, and I'm finally better. So I don't want to cough and sneeze on anybody, but that's why I came out of my house finally, was to share those feelings with you, because I know you're all people of faith, and I appreciate being part of this congregation, so it's my privilege to be here.
The question is, now that we've gotten through a couple of songs, what is your favorite Godspell song or moment, and why?
Well, we haven't gotten to it yet in the movie, but my favorite is Day by Day. Although, that first song, When Wilt Thou Save the People, which was the song that Jesus sings when he makes his first entrance, was the most fun to sing. We were asked to do a sort of a celebration of the installation of a new bishop at the Cathedral St. John the Divine in 1974, I think it was, or three or four. And they asked the company to come and do a song from Godspell, and they asked for Save the People. And I got to stand in the middle of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I don't know if you've ever been there. If you haven't, you should. In the stained glass rosette window, which is like seven stories high. And that was stirring. That was magical, you know, to be part of that in that space. Excuse me. Gives me a lump in my throat. So Save the People, obviously, and Day by Day, which is coming up because it was such a great audience participation tune. And Day by Day was, some of you may be old enough to remember, was number one on the hit parade in the summer of 1971, I guess it was, or 72. It stayed up there for a long time. It was a big, big record because it was so affecting, popular.
Where did the idea of wearing this clown makeup come from?
Some of the kids were there at Carnegie Mellon when this was a master's project, and it wasn't clicking. And finally, John Michael Tebelak, who conceived the show, came in one day with a bunch of makeup and said, here, I want you guys, just play with this. And so they started to paint each other's faces and having a giddy old time. It got sillier and sillier and sillier. And John Michael said, ah, I know what the first scene is about now. I know what we're going to do. And basically, it affected the transformation from everybody's world-weary, you know, they're in their dead-end jobs, and suddenly here comes John the Baptist to sing, Prepare You the Way of the Lord, and they all come to meet him. And the makeup was the way of symbolizing transformation from everyday people to Jesus people, basically. So when I see that, that's always what it reminds me of, you know, how that happened, yes.
Can you tell us about the ending of the show? Some people would say it was controversial.
There's some controversy about the ending. There was always, why is there no resurrection? And then, of course, when we did it in the theater, we always said, well, the resurrection is the curtain call. They would carry me out right through the audience, and then the curtain call music would begin, and we'd all come running down, and I would come running down, and the resurrection was that, you know. Whereas in the movie, they really can't do that, I suppose. It would have looked odd in some way. But we all of course, believe in the risen Christ. So I think the movie itself is the example of that.
Can you tell us a little bit about the spiritual aspect of the show for the cast and for you?
There were times when we did the show where the presence of God was so palpable, you could cut it with a knife. In other words, that it was different from Wednesday night. There's something would happen on a Friday night where, or whatever it was, where it took on a whole other emotional thing. And we all felt that way, and we sort of can't describe it other than the atmosphere in the room changed. The piece felt particularly moving, and obviously, like around Easter time and stuff like that, when Jesus was on everybody's mind, it became very sort of pregnant with that kind of idea. I used to pray before every show and say, please don't let me, you know, make a mockery of this. Let me do this in the right spirit. And I found it very heavy sometimes to play the passion play. It was easy to play the yada yada, all for the best, but there are times when we get into the passion play, particularly Let This Cup Pass Me By, and that whole thing, and the, you know, any actor taking any role kind of inhabits the emotional life of that character. And so just taking the character and playing the emotional life, and, you know, I read tons of stuff, and I had my own experience growing up as a Christian kid and all the rest of it. So the experience sometimes was so powerful and devastating sometimes. And I always never felt worthy, of course, to do it. And just asked for kind of be forgiven for doing it. But also I knew that it was kind of, it was that thing I said when I was a kid, I wanted to be either a priest or an actor. And it was the combination finally of the two. And I think it's why I turned to directing a couple of years after that. I stepped aside from acting because I thought, that's done it. You know, there's nothing, I mean, I got to play that, you know, every night. And what am I going to do? Go back, go on a sitcom? You know, I mean, it just seemed, the whole thing seemed silly. I just played the hero of heroes of all time and the story, the greatest story ever told, and nothing could compare. So I decided to be a mini Jesus and become a director. And so I've been directing for 35 years. And I directed a production of Godspell at the Lambs some years later, too, which was fun.
What was the significance of removing the makeup during the Last Supper scene?
It was to sort of symbolize the fact that we now have to get, we've gone through this process with him, and now we have to accept the new paradigm, I guess. So I'm going to now leave you, and you're going to become yourselves in a new way, having been changed by the gospel. And now we're going to take this off and get to your, it's almost like your naked soul now is revealed again. We put on the makeup so we could play and learn, and now we take it off. So it's kind of like washed clean, was the idea, yeah.
What's the mirror mean?
In the Last Supper? I think it was that, it's an elaboration of that same idea, which is that, no, I'm going to show you now your true self. You've gone through this with me. This is now your true self. You're going to take off the makeup and see your true self.
I'm going to ask one last question. Sure. Before we close. It was so moving to hear about the serving wine to the folks within the theater. Have you heard of that being done? Or was that just on Broadway? Or have you heard about that being done in other performances?
Well, we did it. It was done for the show from the beginning in terms of when I think at La Mama and onward.
Okay.
And they did it in every production that was done off the New York production. In other words, directed and produced by the same people. We always did the wine.
Okay.
Yeah. In Canada, we weren't allowed to serve wine. Okay. So we served grape juice instead. Just like at communion,
like
for
you.
Kids.
Well,
yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again for joining us, Don.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Crossroads. Our managing editor is Jamie Staley, and our editors are Vashina Brisbane and Emily Dombroff.